just a few minutes. In traditional religious experience, this is the index of man's freedom, the freedom of the spirit. The confining shape of a world conception, when penetrated, does not immediately yield a new world, but yields the freedom past the interface membrane. It's only later, not very much later, that a new world conception by habit takes the place of the old. There is a moment, or to use the English language in a more specific way, because it will tolerate this specificity, there is a momentariness, which is true freedom, which generally, in traditional wisdom learning, is given to wisdom, Sophia or Prajna, to experience. The momentariness of freedom, if appreciated, can then be brought back into your attention, can be, as it were, re-entered into again, not recreated. Memory can recreate it, that's true, but usually one is not so adept at this, and so one tries to enter back into that experience again. You can call that momentariness a satori. I think that's probably the best term in human traditions for this. That momentariness of freedom, unconditional freedom. There are no strings attached whatsoever. But the momentum of having a worldview eventually carries over. It's like carries underneath and comes up back through again through a neurological mnemonic processes and begins recreating in a transformed way a new worldview. Now, what's so peculiar about the 20th century is that we have gone through this three times in one century. In the early 1920s, it wasn't so much that Einstein's universe replaced Newton's universe, it's that Einstein confirmed the incredible spread of the Newtonian universe, didn't really displace it. And by the late 1920s, the understanding was is that indeed this expanded universe is very peculiar. And the realization then that 200 years before, we had gone through a major transformation of worldview, but that most people didn't realize it at the time. And the realization came in the 1920s, a delayed reaction, if you will. Now, this is not entirely true, and the reason why scientists thought that it was true, if you excuse me, is because they're illiterate. I don't mean that they don't know how to read. I mean that they do not have the cultivation of understanding that the whole changed motivation of 18th century poetry was due to the influence of the Newtonian dynamic. And since the Second World War, there have been many literary studies on this, and now it's a well-known phenomenon. The greatest figure in this is Shelley. Shelley's poetry is radically different from Philip Sidney's poetry. I'm using him just as an example. His poetry is different from any poetry before. But Sir Philip Sidney's Apology for Poetry is the best statement that one could make in the English language about poetry in its traditional stasis, whereas Shelley's theory of poetry is an incredible, dynamic recutting of the whole conscious idea of what poetry is. The difference is that Shelley lives after Newton, and Shelley was a scientist. He was a mad scientist. He would have gone on and had a distinguished career in science, except that his chemical experiments kept blowing up the family household, and they refused to let him buy more chemicals. You may not go to the sellers and vendors and buy more explosives. It wasn't until the 1920s that the full consciousness of what had happened, that the dynamic universe of Newton had in fact effectively displaced in consciousness the static universe that had existed before. No sooner was that realization firmly in place, and about 3 years later, the whole Newtonian universe was penetrated and shown to be another stasis, and here's a new dynamic that no one has ever entered before. And now in 1990, we're about to experience the penetration and see that yet again, for the third time in this century, what had been thought to be the true dynamic universe was just another static step. But this time, the change is different. This time, there is a consciousness of counting. And the famous formula for counting was given by wonderful George Gamow in his book titled 1, 2, 3 infinity. The progression always runs, and Gamow was just lovable human being, affable, and his mind, George Gamow was like had the same kind of personality that St. Peter had. He loved, in a very burly, manly, friendly way, to get it exactly right. 1, 2, 3, infinity. When you get a progression moving into the fourth element, it's like adding time to the three dimensions of space. You get a space-time, you get a fullness, you get a spiracality. I have to emphasize this to you. You move away from geometry into trigonometry. You move away from geometricities, which at best are accurate patterns, into trigonometricities, which can be spheres, whole domains, realms. You are never analytically capable of dealing with four-dimensional domains in geometry. You have to make the shift. The shift comes in the 1990s, when we enter into a fourth phase, an infinite phase of the cosmological appreciation of the universe. There was the classic, there was the Newtonian, there was the 20th century, there's what comes after. That kind of a thing. Now, notice here, and bear with me just a minute, and we'll take our break. Here's Millikan again, 1927. It was rather the method used by Galileo and followed by Newton and Franklin, Benjamin Franklin, and Faraday, and Maxwell, and Pasteur, and Darwin, and a host of others who caught its significance. The emphasis is on method, the word method. It's italicized. It was this that constituted the great new idea, an idea which is finally brought into the ken, K-E-N, within the purview of mankind, the conception of an evolving, developing, progressing world. So that you're given to understand, for instance, the idea, the patterned consciousness, which is the idea of, say, Darwin's evolution. Darwin's theory of evolution is a patterned consciousness known as an idea. And it belongs to the Newtonian stage of cosmological understanding. When your physics moves beyond the Newtonian, your biological theorizing also receives a quantum jump. And when you move one step further beyond that, the other, in corresponding fashion, receives a likewise asymptotic boost. The two stage, the second step beyond Darwin's theory of evolution in terms of ideas of life progress, is a spiritual infinity, which is just now being brought out in consciousness and just now will be start to be seen everywhere. I hope you're hearing what's being said here. Millikan, 1927. Yale University Press. Through this Newtonian, Darwinian method, we have learned to read the story of the geological evolution of the Earth and of the evolution of life on the Earth, of human history and civilization, of the stars themselves, and even of the elements of which the stars are made. It is the most sublime, the most stimulating conception that has ever entered human thought, the conception of progress, also italicized, progress. Now the idea of progress is very, very powerful patterned template of consciousness. What pulls the strings of the developers who bulldoze the Oaks in Beverly Hills to build more condos? Progress. It's the same strings that yield Daniel Ortega to say, well, we want to change everything around for progress. Notice that the step beyond that, the stage beyond that, is not to bulldoze those oaks. It takes long time to grow those beautiful oaks. Can't you build so that you utilize the oaks? And in correspondence, the idea that's sweeping Eastern Europe now. We don't have to organize ourselves in some Newtonian, Darwinian way. There is a whole more humane way of organizing ourselves. By consulting each other about really what do we really want? What do we really need? Instead of what do those in power think that we need to make us happy, let's ask each other, are you happy? Well, if not, stop it. Let's do something else. Notice that. Also notice that there is a step beyond even that. And the next step beyond even that is being taken even now. A dimension that opens up and considers that your happiness is not just what you might consider this specific little existence to require right now, but what about your whole life wave in all of its universal? Let's consult each other about that. What about the health of all of our life waves? You can see the sphericality. You can see the trigonometric dimension coming in. You can see that the domain of the spirit becomes the true context of action then. The true context of ritual. That's what this educational program is all about, is to acquaint you with that fourth stage, that spherical trigonometric stage, that almost nowhere that you look is enunciated. No one speaks to that. one more lifetime, everyone will speak to that. Millikan, again, 1927. I'm trying to build you up to show you the contrast between Millikan in 1927 and Dirac in 1930. There's a fracture line here. Millikan belongs to the second stage, Dirac to the third stage. And even though there's just a couple of years, 3 years, this is January 1927, technically, and Dirac is May of 1930. Just a few years. There is a quantum jump between what Millikan is saying about the idea of progress and what Dirac will say about the principles of quantum mechanics. There is a quantum jump in energy. So, too, there is a quantum jump between what I am telling you and what Dirac was able to say in the principles of quantum mechanics in 1930. There's more difference between what I'm giving to you from Dirac, and from Dirac, from Millikan, and from Millikan from somebody in the 750s AD. The steps are larger each time. It's like the step to Newton was going from the Earth to the Moon, and the step from Newton to quantum mechanics is like going from the Moon to the nearest star, and what I'm giving you is like stepping out of a galaxy. It's a jump in dimensions, in whole orders of possibility. Let's make the fracture line visible, and then we'll take a break. Millikan again, 1927, Yale University Press. He's the big cheese at Caltech. He's on the cutting edge. I'm using him as an example because he was ostensibly the best there was in the world at the time. I'm trying to show you that the best there was in the world at the time, in just a few years, was eclipsed totally. Absolutely. As we used to say in the 60s, blown out. Millikan, is it not the most sublime, the most stimulating conception that has ever entered human thought? This conception of progress, this new idea, absolutely unknown in ancient times, a progress of which we are a part, and in which we are ourselves consciously playing a role of supreme importance. A progress which whatever doubts Dean Inge and Professor Bury may give voice to, the man on the streets now partially understands and certainly believes in, for has he not in his own lifetime seen the most capricious, the most terrible of the phenomenon of nature, the thunderbolts of Jove, become the willing slaves of all mankind, so that 6 million workers in America alone are today supported directly or indirectly by the electrical industry? Notice that the metaphor of power is harnessing lightning. Can you imagine the shock to a consciousness like that just 15 years later seeing the atom bomb? The scale between an atomic bomb and lightning bolt is quite a quantum jump in scale. Let's go to Dirac. Let's go to the preface. This is a reprint from Oxford. The preface from the first edition, Dirac, May 29th, 1930, St. John's College, Cambridge. The methods of progress in theoretical physics have undergone a vast change in the present century. The classical tradition has been to consider the world to be an association of observable objects, particles, fluids, fields, etc., moving about according to the definite laws of force. One of the things that Millikan makes a great deal out of is Newton's great equation about force, and he brings it into play again and again in his book. I don't want to go back to Millikan right now, but he makes a great deal out of this about Newton's equations of, if you want to read it for yourself, it's on page 44, and I'll just leave it up here. Dirac is saying, the classical tradition, and he's including under classical tradition now the whole Newtonian worldview. What's classical to Dirac is not the same as what was classical to Milken. Dirac has already entered into the third phase. He says, all those guys up until now, because the jump, when you make the jump in consciousness, when the pattern capacity, when you can see the pattern in your consciousness in this new phase, this third phase, the difference between the first and second phase is almost negligible. And I must tell you this in all humility. The difference between Dirac and Newton and Democritus is hardly worth mentioning. From where I sit, hardly worth mentioning at all. It's of interest historically. It's like three different flavors of lollipop. Whatever you want, you can. You don't even have to have lollipops anymore if you don't want to. The classical tradition, writes Dirac, has been to consider the world to be an association of observable objects. There are those objects. They can be fluids, fields, particles, moving about according to definite laws of force so that one could form a mental picture in space and time of the whole scheme. In the third stage, one comes to realize you cannot form a mental picture. This is why the 60s phrase was blown out. What's blown out? The mind. What's blown out of the mind? What blows your mind? The fact that there are no more images. Most people that didn't go through don't understand the colloquialism anymore. Well, it blows my mind. They say it as if they've got gas. It was a spiritual statement. It meant that, hey, I don't walk around with mental images anymore. I don't have any pictures. When I talk to you, I talk to you, not to some picture I have of you. And I find you lovely just as you are. And I wouldn't dare make some kind of inarticulate, cribbed little sketches to try and replace you in my love for you. That's the way it used to be. Much, much better. So that one could form a mental picture in space and time of the whole scheme. This led to a physics whose aim was to make assumptions about the mechanism and forces connecting these observable objects, to account for their behavior in the most simplest possible way. It has become increasingly evident in recent times, however, very recent times, that nature works on a different plan. Her fundamental laws do not govern the world as it appears in our mental picture in any direct way. But instead, they control a substratum of which we cannot form a mental picture without introducing irrelevancies. In other words, the mental pictures contaminate the exactness of the real. And if you can drink contaminated water and live that way, that's fine. But if you are mature and need fresh water, you don't want the contaminants. If you're mature and you want to experience someone as they really are, you don't want to have prejudices in the way or prejudgments in the way. Or remembering, that son of a bitch said that about me. You don't want that in the way. You want to be there with them as they are, in their protean fullness, it's a whole different scale of humanity. Dirac, this is in a preface to The Principles of Quantum Mechanics. Her fundamental laws do not govern the world as it appears in our mental picture in any very direct way, but instead they control a substratum of which we cannot form a mental picture without introducing irrelevancies. The formulation of these laws requires the use of the mathematics of transformations. You can't use arithmetic anymore. The mathematics, you can't just use mathematics anymore. The mathematics of transformations. And you hear all kinds of people talking about transformation, transformation, as if it were just another coat of paint. It ain't. The important things in the world appear as the invariants, or more generally, the nearly invariants, or quantities with simple transformation properties of these transformations. These, the things we are immediately aware of, are the relations of these nearly invariants to a certain frame of reference, usually one chosen so as to introduce special simplifying features which are unimportant from the point of view of general theory. Here it is. The growth of the use of transformation theory as applied first to relativity and later to the quantum theory is the essence of the new method in theoretical physics. This is 1930. What else came out in 1930? The Secret of the Golden Flower by Carl Jung and Richard Dawkins. Came out not very far from where this was published. Their concomitants on a thought wave which is penetrating through a cosmological frame of reference. One more image for your imagelessness, and then we'll take a break. There's a great Renaissance painting, high Renaissance painting, actually it's an engraving done, of all the Ptolemaic universe, of the realms of the moon and the planets and the sun and everything, and some Renaissance magus is grown so big that he can stick his head outside and he sees that beyond the fixed star limitation of the old world view, that there's something else out there. Yeah. Take a break. Let's come back to where, notice how we use a textbook. You don't read a textbook from cover to cover. That's not what a textbook is. The idea of a textbook underwent a radical transformation. The original idea of a textbook in antiquity was in the mind of a man whose name was Isidore of Seville. Spain at that time was a part of the decaying ancient Roman world, and he's the one who decided that nobody could read all this stuff. So he'd take quotations from here and quotations from there and so forth, imitating an Alexandrian named Athenodorus, and only he put them together not to be just edifying reading, as Athenodorus had done, but Athenaeus, rather, had done. But Isidore of Seville made a textbook. And that textbook and its later imitation, the sentences of Peter, I forget his final name, Peter of some place, the selections of Isidore of Seville and the sentences of Peter, somebody or other, were the standard textbooks for 1,000 years in the West. No other textbooks were used, and all little minds were caught in the same little picayune pattern, which is why no one could think.
first crack. And that whole ensemble of sobbingness was Ficino, who said, "Look what's not in Isidore. All of the recently found Hermetic treatises, all of the recently recovered Platonic dialogues, all of the Aeneids of Plotinus, they ain't in Isidore, they ain't in the textbook. And all of this is necessary nutritional material." And all of a sudden, minds could think on a scale that hadn't been seen for some 1,200 years. Can you imagine? That's why it's called the Renaissance. The young 16-year-old Michelangelo sitting up at the Via Correggi listening to Ficino. Fantastic ideas of what could be done, finally. And others, Botticelli, and so forth. The revolution, though, in the textbook idea did not come until the 1660s. In the city at that time, which was on the cutting edge of consciousness, Amsterdam. In the 1660s in Amsterdam, you had Spinoza and Rembrandt and John Amos Comenius. And it's Comenius who made the revolution in textbooks. The English translation of the title is The World in Pictures, Orbis Picturis. I have a copy here in reprint. Well, there have been several revolutions in textbooks since Comenius. Two, to be precise. One is the revolution that came in the earlier part of the 20th century to utilize the textbook as a matrix instead of the world in pictures. Kenneth Patchen's great 1947 title for one of his books of poems, "Here is a box wherein you can keep all journeys." And Patchen succinctly in that title tells about third stage textbooks. Well, we're using fourth stage textbooks here. You don't read a book from cover to cover in a textbook, but you use the entire book in a intuitionally related way. You have not only this textbook, this one, and I can't hold all these in one hand. These are the textbooks. The whole ensemble is a matrix. And for thought to be free, we have to be able to enter in and exit in all kinds of curlicues that would not be available were one to use linear thought or even patterned thought. But to use free form, insight thought, is different. So I'm introducing here in the Saturday course a new way to speak about a textbook. And this is the what can be said and what cannot be said, the exclamation mark after the om, is the text that's not here in this matrix but occurs nevertheless. The one we're going to use in the cycle will be the Tao Te Ching this time, but in the next cycle will be the Bhagavad Gita. I'm shifting them around so that when the ideational amperage hits the pattern, the Bhagavad Gita will be a better summation than the Tao Te Ching. This time the Tao Te Ching is the right summation because it's been a loose process. And the next time, when we get to this stage in 1991, the Tao Te Ching will not work as a summation, only the Bhagavad Gita will work. So it'll be somewhat different next time. But I'm showing you this so that you can see that we're not using any kind of sophomoric level of education. This education has nothing to do with what passes for education in a university. or what passes for New Age, this or that. The New Age was in times of Franklin and Jefferson and Newton. There's been at least one major transformation beyond that. And this is speaking to a transformation beyond that transformation. It's a whole different realm. It has nothing to do with the familiar. It has everything to do with the unknown. There must be a word for astronauts of the unknown, and that's what we are about. One of our elements, then, in our textbook matrix happens to bear the title The Particle Explosion. And we started this morning about talking about the new particles, page 72 and 73, and now we're jumping to page 85, I believe. Should be. Yeah, 85. And on page 84, there's an illustration, appropriately in green and red. And you can see in the illustration the double curl. And in a way, this double curl is a nuclear physics level of presenting what in classical Greek architectural expression was the Corinthian column. This happens to be figure 5.2, which bears this description. Invisible gamma ray photons produce pairs of electrons, green, and positrons, red. A pair. Their grammar is incorrect here. It produces a pair. An electron, a positron, which curl in opposite directions, forming a new Corinthian column for a new kind of architecture in which man can have his home. A subatomic particle home where he can live in a universal way, not only rain or shine, but whether there's any rain or any shine at all. Invisible gamma ray photons produce pairs of electrons, green, and positrons, red, in a bubble chamber in the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory. It's up near the top of the campus in Berkeley. When it's working, it has an eerie blue-white light. And it's only after meditating for a while that you begin to realize that what you're seeing there in the reactor, when it's glowing in that way, is actually a star. And you realize that man has grown to the extent that he can put a star in a box. Very complicated, very weird, very powerful box, but nevertheless, that's what is eerie about it. Not many people have seen it, and not many people with a meditative penetration have seen it. But when you do, it's unmistakable. It's seeing. That star has been brought out of the cosmos and put here in man's hand, as it were. It's a very odd feeling, I tell you. Then comes the text facing this bubble chamber electrograph. It reads, in part, all the atoms of matter contain negatively charged electrons and positive protons. The total negative and positive charge are equal, making matter electrically neutral overall. So that, for instance, when there is an interreaction in the material world, it isn't on the nuclear level. It's on the outer rims of the electron level. So that all chemical, and thus all biochemical processes, happen because there's interchange on the outermost periphery. If you look at the periodic table of elements, you'll notice that it goes up to Roman numeral 7a. that's the full extent of the interreaction. No matter how many elements are discovered, transuranium elements, and now we're up to, I think, 107 or 108, something like that. One can see that all elements fall into this periodic table, which incidentally is one of the master mind ideas contemporary science, even though it was made about 100 years ago by a Russian named Mendeleev. And a masterful conception, the periodic table. So all elements are basically neutral overall, and it's only because they become skewed because of getting or losing an electron that they can interreact at all. In other words, matter, if it is complete, doesn't react with other matter. It's the incompleteness of the physical world that allows for process to happen. It's just like a yogi who perfects himself and fills in all the electron shells. He doesn't interact with the world anymore at all. And doesn't have any effect. He doesn't oxidize at all. You must understand, it's not just metaphorical. When Huineg de-oxidized himself, he did it with his physical body too. His physical body still exists in China. It has the consistency of anthracite coal. He self-mummified himself as an example to show the physical world, when it's mastered, it's mastered. You don't have to decay at all. But you also don't have any more use for that level. But we can, they write in the particle explosion, but we can imagine a world in which electrons are positive and protons negative. World of antimatter. And in fact, it's not just an imagination, but worlds of antimatter exist. Not only of antimatter, there are many kinds of matter. So peculiar that one of the kinds of matter is called strange. There are whole worlds, there are whole universes of strange matter that are neither matter nor antimatter. There are whole universes of charmed matter. These are the kinds of words that are used by the people who have seen them in consciousness. Strange and charmed are scientific terms and not just metaphorical. Let's pause for a second. The positron. All right, we can imagine a world where in which electrons are positive and protons negative. After all, the definitions of positive and negative are purely arbitrary. Check that. Let's try it again. The definitions of positive and negative, we know now in scientific consciousness, are purely arbitrary. It's like Jack Kerouac asks in Mexico City Blues, what time is it really in the universe? Even with a cesium atomic decay watch, well, it's extremely accurate, but What's the setting? You see. We're accurate to the extent that we know now that it's all arbitrary. All of it, 100%, is arbitrary. Notice how the universe is becoming more and more consistent with freedom. So that when someone says to you that you are free, those words can reverberate as far as you want to carry them. You are free. And any constraint on you is technically arbitrary. what is important for atoms is that electrons and protons have opposite charges and are bound together by the electric force. All that's important is that the polarity, in any which way you want, maintains its relationality in view of a flow. As long as there is a flow in a polarized structure, a universe will form and all attendant phenomena will manifest. That's all. It's a very small requirement. God's shopping list is very short. But what wonders he can cook up with just a few ingredients. Nature, however, seems to have made a choice. Nature. What nature? The nature that our whole educational program begins with. The nature in which we find ourselves occurring mainly, at least initially. If you follow this program through,